on this edition for Saturday, October 6th.
On this vote, the ayes are 50, the nays are 48. The nomination of Brett M. Kavanaugh of Maryland to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States is confirmed.
Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Hari Srinivasan.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. This afternoon, amid protests from spectators in the Senate gallery that repeatedly disrupted the vote, Judge Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed as an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court by a vote of 50 to 48.
The Sergeant at Arms will restore order in the gallery.
The vote came after hours of speeches throughout last night and today, and as protesters gathered all day at the Capitol and at the Supreme Court. Joining us now from the Capitol Rotunda with the latest is Niels Lesniewski, senior writer at Roll Call and CQ News. Niels, you were at the Rotunda. Tell us what was going on as we were struggling to figure out what was happening in the C-SPAN cameras because they don't cover the galleries. What did you see? What did you hear?
Sure. It's good to be with you, Hari. I was on the second floor of the Capitol, just outside of the chamber, when all of a sudden we heard what you probably saw on those cameras, which are operated by the Senate recording studio, and it became clear that there were a number of protesters who were yelling in the chamber. We had seen similar yesterday on Capitol Hill as well. 14 arrests, we believe, were made today from protesters who were actually shouting in the galleries as the votes got underway. There were more protesters outside who had at one point earlier in the day basically stormed onto the front of the Capitol and made, some of them actually made their way up the stairs. They were outside the building, but some of them had made their way up a staircase that you normally don't see members of the public on. So this was sort of to be expected, but it was nonetheless the level of tension, particularly I think with the from the Secret Service agents who were standing near me, who were here because of Vice President Mike Pence being in the building. There were clearly tense moments today.
Niels, this is just the tip of the protest that we saw on TV or we heard. There have been protests outside, as you point out, really in the past 24 hours. Has this momentum been building? I mean, were there other arrests that the Capitol Police had to make?
There certainly were. I actually was seeing a lot of arrests being made myself over the last couple of days, including in the atrium of the Hart Senate office building, which is one of the three main office buildings used by the Senate. There have been other arrests for various disruption of proceedings or blocking of hallways and Senate offices throughout. Frankly, because there's a holiday weekend that is upon us, we're probably going to be seeing more protests out in some of the states. And police officers and, senators have had extra police officers and security with them, both inside and outside the Capitol complex in recent weeks. That's really unlike anything that we have seen when there hasn't been a real threat that's sort of specific.
Niels, finally, there has also been talk from, say, Gerald Nadler of New York and saying, hey, listen, if the Democrats take over the House this coming election, that these investigations are not over, that this nomination could still, actually, I should say this confirmation or this confirmed justice could still be investigated?
Certainly there might be some talk of that in the House. I'm not getting really that much of an appetite for it. On the Senate side, Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat who's from Illinois, was telling a group of reporters yesterday that really there's too much work to be done in the coming weeks and probably after the election. He wants to get back to work on appropriation bills and things that can be done in a bipartisan manner. And the other thing your viewers should know quickly is that impeachment and removal is really not something that's going to be on the table. It takes 67 votes, really, in the Senate to convict in an impeachment trial.
All right. Niels Lesniewski, senior writer at Roll Call and CQ. Thanks for joining us. I'm joined here in the studio with Jamie Floyd. She's a legal analyst at New York Public Radio and the local host of WNYC's All Things Considered. And also with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Emily Bassalon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and a lecturer at Yale Law School. Thank you both for being here. Let me start with something that happened last night. I want to play a clip here for you, if I can. At Princeton University, current Supreme Court Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan remarked on their experiences in the Supreme Court in what they acknowledged was a politically divided time. Let's take a listen.
It's an incredibly important thing for the court to guard, is this reputation of being fair, of being impartial, of being neutral, and of not being simply an extension of the terribly polarized political process and environment that we live in. And this is a challenge.
Jamie Floyd, I want to start with you. As the other two branches of government become increasingly polarized, will it be possible to keep that out of the Supreme Court? I mean, what kind of damage has been done to that institution during this confirmation hearing?
Well, clearly, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, who was there with her at Princeton, are concerned about that. And I'm so glad, Hari, that you started here with the two of the women justices speaking on this point. They're clearly very concerned. And this is an extraordinary thing that they spoke about this. Justice Kagan went on to say that the legitimacy of the court relies upon public confidence in the court and in its independence, that if the public loses faith in the court, loses respect for the court, and loses a sense credibility, of the court's credibility, that they won't listen to what we tell them to do. That's basically what she came out and said. We tell them we don't have an army, she said. We don't have an army. We can't order with masses of force the public to do things. We order through our legitimacy. And without that, all is lost for the court. And that's her concern. And she said that last night. And it was a bold thing to say. And I'm so glad you started there, because it shows tremendous concern on the part of at least these two justices about what's happened these last few weeks.
Emily Bassalon, what about the credibility of the court? How has that been put into question, especially with the number of women and men who believe the accuser, not the accused, in this situation?
Right. I think the court does face questions about its legitimacy, and the fact that Brett Kavanaugh, in his second round of testimony, launched a, you know, heated partisan attack against Democrats will give a lot of people questions about his impartiality. The best way for the court to try to deal with that as a body is to be unified when possible. But we're facing a situation that is very different than the last 60 years. Over the last 60 years, we have had swing justices and justices who drifted ideologically. So we had a lot of Republican appointees not behaving as partisan actors and really giving the court an image and a reality of impartiality and nonpartisanship. Now we have five committed conservative Republican appointees and four more liberal Democratic appointees. And that partisan division is going to be a real challenge for the court going forward with exactly these kinds of legitimacy questions you're asking.
Jamie Floyd, the conversation that was spurred by Susan Collins yesterday, she made an impassioned argument for her reasoning on why she voted the way she did. She made her, in her case, she talked about the presumption of innocence, which resonates enormously with the people who support Kavanaugh right now. She's saying it comes back down to that, and I needed more evidence to corroborate this. That seems like a reasonable argument.
But this was not a court of law, and the Kavanaugh detractors, if you will, pointed that out. We're not in a court of law, and perhaps we need a different standard to apply when we're to advise and give consent to a president who's making an appointment. And so now, Justice Kavanaugh, I hope, and I'm sure he was listening to Senator Collins when she made an appeal to him to set aside the bias that was revealed in his opening statement, to set aside concerns about why perhaps this was happening to him at this time. Because now he's going to have to convince people that some of those words that were spoken, and he wrote in the Wall Street Journal on Thursday already, mm-hmm. that he was speaking as a son, as a father, and as a husband, perhaps not as a jurist, but now he has to be a jurist on the highest court in the land. And so Senator Collins is hoping that he can return to the temperament we saw in the first round of hearings, rather than the man we saw in that second round.
Emily Bazelon, you know, there in terms of the supporters, you see this, and I've just picked up this off of Twitter. This is not a vote against women or for rape. It's a vote for due process, fairness, and the principle of innocence until proven guilty, whether in the court of law or the court of public opinion. No corroboration, refuted claims. That seems to be something that resonates, especially in the base that supports Trump right now. They're just as excited about the fact that he is becoming a Supreme Court justice as the people who believe Christine Blasey Ford and are very disappointed and frustrated.
Those are worthy principles and principles we should hold dear. I think there's a certain irony in hearing them strongly from conservatives who in other settings have been quite quick to reduce the presumption of innocence when there are a lot of people's lives are on the line, when people go to prison, a lot of poor people, a lot of people of color. And I think also there's important context here about sexual assault and the problems women have had in the past with being believed, with being found credible. There was a lot of lip service to the idea that Christine Blasey Ford was credible, and yet in the end, that didn't seem to matter so much. It was as if the goalposts had moved for her.
Hey, Emily, I want to ask you both, Emily first, what are the political ripples of this? Does this galvanize enough people on either side? It seems like it's galvanizing both sides to show up to the polls in 6 weeks.
You know, traditionally, conservatives have been much more successful in mobilizing their base around the importance of the Supreme Court. That has a lot to do with the idea of overturning Roe versus Wade. Now they've gotten an appointment that they dearly wanted, yep. and the question will be whether they stay motivated or whether it is Democrats and liberals who, you know, feel outraged by this confirmation who will come to the polls in November. That's the big question. And yeah. going forward, we'll have to see how this court performs in terms of how the American people responds to it. Does it stay right. in sync with the American public, or does it start to stray far afield from the kinds of decisions people will support?
We do find that it is the losing side that is motivated in the midterm process.
Yeah.
And here that would be women, people who have felt victimized by sexual assault and sexual harassment,
right.
and clearly those who ideologically did not agree with the Kavanaugh nomination. So it remains to be seen in just a few short weeks in November.
All right, Jamie Floyd, Emily Bazelon, thank you both.
Thank you.
Watch the full Senate vote on Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation at our website, pbs.org/newshour. The death toll from the 7.5 magnitude earthquake and tsunami that struck Indonesia over a week ago is now more than 1,600. The number of victims is expected to rise as rescuers continue to search through the rubble. In the hard-hit city of Palu, the government is considering halting searches and turning some areas into mass graves. Several neighborhoods completely sank into the earth when the quake liquefied soft soil. Red Cross volunteers have reached some of the remote regions of the country to provide medical aid to the sick and injured. And today, an Australian military transport landed in the disaster-struck Sulawesi province to deliver much-needed supplies. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Tokyo today for high-level talks before he travels to North Korea tomorrow. Pompeo met with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to coordinate a unified policy toward North Korea. The U.S. is under increased pressure to push North Korea into giving up its nuclear weapons. Pompeo is also seeking to arrange a second summit meeting between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The Secretary of State will also travel to China and South Korea during his three-day Asia tour. The candidates in Brazil's presidential race are wrapping up their campaigns today before tomorrow's election. Far-right frontrunner Jair Bolsonaro promises to privatize state companies, relax environmental rules for farming and mining, and block the legalization of abortion and gay marriage. Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad is Bolsonaro's closest rival. He entered the race just a month ago after former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was barred from running when he was sentenced to prison on corruption charges. If no candidate wins a majority tomorrow, there will be a second runoff between the two top candidates on October 28th. First Lady Melania Trump wrapped up a four-country trip to Africa with a stop in Egypt today. The First Lady toured the Sphinx and stopped to talk to reporters about her support for the nomination process for Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who she called highly qualified. And she shared her behind-the-scenes discussions with her husband about his tweets.
Well, I don't always agree what he tweets. And I tell him that. I give him my honest opinion and honest advice. And sometimes he listens and sometimes he doesn't. But I have my own voice and my opinions. And it's very important for me that I express what I feel.
We continue the coverage we began last week on the resurgence of the terror group ISIS in Libya. NewsHour Weekend Special Correspondent Chris Livesay was recently the first American broadcast journalist legally allowed into the country in almost a year. In part two of his report, he and videographer Alessandro Pavone traveled to a city where ancient ruins collide with modern warfare. It's also a place where human trafficking stretches and even breaks the bonds of family and tribe. This story was made possible with special funding from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
Once a jewel of the Roman Empire, Libya's port city of Sabratha is home to an ancient amphitheater that more recently was the backdrop of a city overrun by terror. ISIS took control in 2015 and asserted its authority by beheading 12 members of the security forces and setting up its own checkpoints. Today, the tables are turned. Libyan police, loyal to the government in Tripoli, now check for ISIS militants. One of them tells me the city is safe. But checkpoints are common targets for terrorist attacks, and any one of these vehicles could be packed with explosives. Police are also looking for stolen fuel. ISIS is known to smuggle it from Libya's vast reserves and use the profits to fund their attacks. Libya's spot on the map makes it particularly attractive to terrorists. Parts of the sprawling country, three times the size of France, are ungoverned, and the country has largely uncontrolled borders, offering several gateways for action, says Carnegie Endowment senior associate Frederick Wary.
Libya is still a fertile ground, you know, for ISIS to regroup, to conduct attacks, to include external attacks outside of Libya, whether on Tunisia or even Europe, and I think this is a huge concern for American policymakers. The U.S. has always recognized that the Libyan branch of the Islamic State was the most potent affiliate outside of Iraq and Syria, and so it could very well reemerge as a very significant threat to North Africa and to Europe. Now, they're not able to control territory like they did in 2016, but they're still able to conduct attacks, as we've seen. They're adopting a clandestine network strategy.
I visit this former ISIS base in Sabratha, where in 2016, American intelligence indicated several dozen militants had been training for an operation, possibly in nearby Europe. The U.S. bombed the site. Among those killed was the alleged mastermind of two major attacks on Western tourists in neighboring Tunisia. A local approaches me and my interpreter. He says he witnessed the American airstrike. He asks us not to show his face or use his name. Everyone around here is part of the same tribe, and he could get in trouble with relatives, he says.
So you came out here when you heard the explosion?
Yes. I was the first person here.
And what did you see?
I saw smoke, rubble, and bodies everywhere. But there were survivors. Some drove away in a car. One was the leader of the ISIS cell. He's still on the loose. His wife just had a baby.
And how does he know this?
He's my uncle. Like I said, we're all part of the same tribe in this area.
We head for the beach, where just a few hundred miles of open sea separate Libya from Europe.
Until recently, this entire coastline was controlled by ISIS. It's safer now, but locals say we still need to be extremely careful because of possible sleeper cells.
We're met by a Coast Guard commander named Jalal Dabashi. He says his top priority is cracking down on illegal migrants and the well-armed gangs who traffic them.
Sabratha used to be known as the migrant capital of Libya. Traffickers smuggle the migrants from sub-Saharan Africa across the desert to the shore of the Mediterranean Sea.
Traffickers would then pack migrants in this warehouse like merchandise, he says, before shipping them off to Europe in overcrowded, rickety boats. Sometimes, he adds, traffickers here worked hand-in-hand with ISIS, and in nearby locations still do.
They share a common interest, money. When ISIS was around, trafficking was at its peak. Traffickers paid ISIS a tax so they could send migrants across the sea to Europe. We're talking 3 or 4 boatloads every day, millions of dollars per month. Sometimes they would even put terrorists on the migrant ships to Europe. I heard this directly from the biggest trafficker in Sabratha. He happens to be my cousin.
Sorry, your cousin is a migrant trafficker. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, he is my cousin. Me? I'm an officer of the law.
Tribal bonds run deep in Sabratha, but that doesn't mean everyone gets along with those in their tribe.
He sends me threatening messages. He wants to kill me.
Dabashi plays the most recent death threat. His cousin calls him the biggest cockroach he's ever seen. Even if you're in an armored car, he continues, I will burn you alive inside. You will see my revenge. The two cousins eventually met in battle. Late last year, Libyan security forces attacked traffickers positioned at the ancient ruins of Sabratha, severely damaging the UNESCO heritage site.
So that's from an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade.
A local security official shows me the aftermath.
So on this side you had the Libyan army, on the other side you had the traffickers, and this monument was trapped in the middle.
Yes, trapped in the middle.
He tells me Libyan security forces eventually won, but the traffickers continue their lucrative migrant trade in neighboring towns. Fighting traffickers is just one more front in this battle for control of a brittle country. Libya has been in turmoil ever since the 2011 NATO-backed overthrow of strongman Muammar Gaddafi. This summer, some of the most violent clashes in years erupted between rival factions, killing over 100 people in the capital, Tripoli. The chaos works in ISIS's favor, says the Carnegie Endowment's Fred Wary.
I've always argued that the best, recruiter for ISIS is Libya's political turmoil, is its political fragmentation, because this creates economic despair, it creates political losers who gravitate toward radicalization. And just now, in the midst of all this fighting, you've seen an uptick in attacks by the Islamic State.
Ghassan Salameh is the UN Special Envoy to Libya.
The only way to fight terrorist groups on the longer term and in a systematic way is that you have a national authority doing that, controlling its borders, controlling its territory, and moving around to repress any terrorist activity. Do we have that now in Libya? The answer is clearly no.
It's a problem that vexes Colonel Ibrahim bin Rabah, the commander of counterterrorism forces in the city of Sirte. In part one of our report, he told us how he witnessed ISIS's trademark cruelty when they ruled his city and killed his son in battle. His men eventually defeated ISIS here. But now, less than 2 years later, he says, militants are regrouping and waiting to strike again.
Just yesterday, my men spotted several ISIS militants trying to re-enter the city. We almost didn't let you journalists come today because it was too dangerous. ISIS has not disappeared.
But Libya has other problems. Rival factions in Tripoli are violently challenging the authority of the UN-backed government. In response, the UN-backed government has transferred some 300 counterterrorism troops from around western Libya to quell the violence in the capital. That means fewer soldiers looking out for ISIS. Rabah says underestimating Islamic State can have serious repercussions far beyond Libya. If the terror group is not stopped here, he says, it's just a matter of time before ISIS grows and strikes again elsewhere.
The Islamic State is not only our problem. It's like a cancer spreading all around the world. Today, ISIS is here. Tomorrow, it can spread again somewhere else. It's as simple as that.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.